Hello, I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Coming up after the news, it's Philosophy Talk.
So what's on your mind today, Ken?
Free will, you know, this absolute control that we have over our thoughts, our actions, our decisions. I love freedom.
Oh, Ken, it's just an illusion. I mean, if God isn't in control of everything, at least the laws of nature are. You're just the unfolding of a causal sequence that began long before you were born. Grow up.
It doesn't feel like that. It feels like when I act, I act. I decide. I have kind of absolute dominion over what I will do or won't do. That's how it feels to me.
Well, it feels that way because it's your desires and your wants that make you do what you want. But where did those wants and desires come from? You're just a pawn of history, Ken.
Oh, gee, that would mean that free will is an illusion. Let's see if that's right. Wait, stay tuned for Philosophy Talk after the news. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. Hey, Ken, do you know the difference between Fox News and Philosophy Talk?
Oh, we're good and they're bad?
No. One questions everything except your intelligence, and one questions nothing except your intelligence.
That's John Perry, and I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW 91.7 in San Francisco, the oldest, most innovative public radio station around.
And we're continuing conversations that begin down the road at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Where everybody's free and autonomous, John.
Free and autonomous. That's our topic for today. Freedom, determinism, moral responsibility, autonomy. But since you're younger and have a supple mind, why don't we start by you explaining some of these terms to me? Start with freedom.
Okay.
What do you mean by that?
Well, freedom. You know, when I act out of my desires. I do something in particular, but I act freely when I act when I could have done otherwise. Although I bopped you over the head, I could have not bopped you over the head. That makes me free.
Okay, so let's suppose that one day you bopped me over the head because you've got kind of a tick in your arm, and it was totally, as we would say, involuntary. The next day you bop me over the head because somebody's holding a gun to your head. Those aren't free, I guess. But
right.
The third day you just decide, gee, it'd be fun to bop Perry over the head, and you do it. That's free.
Well, but, yeah, right. I bop you because I want to, and I could have not bopped you, but I did it because I wanted to. And determinism is, you know, what is nature like? It's this relentless chain of causation, relentless necessitation. One thing follows another without any choice. And if we're part of nature, then we're just part of nature. We're just part of this relentless chain of causation. So my desires that cause me to act, they're just more events in these relentless causal chains.
So there seems to be a problem. If determinism is true, are we really free? And then there's another aspect to the problem is it looks like if we're not free, we're really not responsible for anything.
Now, help me believe that if we're not free, we're not responsible.
Well, you hold somebody morally responsible when they had a choice, when they could have done otherwise, when they could have done something different. But if they're just working out the ages-old causal chain that really began long before they were born and their very wants and desires and personality and character are just the result of the past, how can we hold them morally responsible?
Well, that's a good question, you know? I mean, it's like, so somebody commits a murder and you say that if I can show that maybe they had a bad upbringing or something like that and they were kind of beaten by their parents and they were determined to do it because of all this past stuff, then they get off scot-free just like that?
Well, you know, Ken, that's not just an abstract possibility discussed by philosophers. There have actually been cases in the courtroom where it was argued that people should get off or at least their punishment should be diminished because of the fact that their actions were determined in cause. A Twinkie defense was famous in San Francisco.
Oh, you're right. And it's not just in the courtroom. It's also in the cinema. And, you know, our roving philosophical reporter, Amy Standen, she examined the 1948 film classic, the Hitchcock film Rope. She files this report.
We've actually done it exactly as we planned. And not a single infinitesimal thing has gone wrong. It was perfect.
Yes.
An immaculate murder. We've killed for the sake of danger and for the sake of killing. We're alive. Truly and wonderfully alive.
In the Alfred Hitchcock movie Rope, two young men kill an acquaintance of theirs just for the thrill of committing what they think is the perfect crime.
Brandon, how did you feel?
When?
During it?
I don't know, really. I don't remember feeling very much of anything until his body went limp. and I knew it was over.
And then?
Then I felt tremendously exhilarated.
The movie is based on the infamous 1924 murder of a young Chicago man by two of his friends, Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb. What really made the case famous was the impassioned defense built by the murderer's lawyer, Clarence Darrow. Darrow argued it was the boy's character, along with an unhealthy interest in Friedrich Nietzsche, that had led them to kill. "Nature is strong and she is pitiless," said Darrow before the jury. "She works in mysterious ways and we are her victims. We have not much to do with it ourselves. Nature takes this job in hand, and we only play our parts."
Clarence Darrow argued that because they had committed this murder, there must be something wrong with their brain. And as a result, they couldn't have done anything other than what they did. And as a result of that, they couldn't possibly be responsible for it.
In other words, the boys didn't have free will. They were merely instruments of their own nature. Hilary Bock is an associate professor of philosophy at Johns Hopkins University.
If we adopted that view, the first thing we might be tempted to think is, well, if no one is responsible for anything, then maybe we don't get to punish people at all. Maybe we should just say, well, if you did something wrong, that means there must be some problem with you. And then we might think, well, maybe you should be treated for those things, not punished. I think that at some point, this would break down, and people would say, well, wait a minute, the fact that I voluntarily make bad decisions, that of itself should be enough to ensure that I can be put in jail.
After all, if you can't be punished for doing something wrong, you can't be rewarded for doing something right either. It's in that moment when you sit down, count to 10, and make the choice that you're essentially flexing the free will muscle. This is a distinctly human talent, one you can't always expect, by the way, from a chimpanzee.
They have a lot of things in common with us, but one thing they don't have in common with us is the ability to stop and frame for themselves explicitly the question, what kinds of rules do I want to act on? What kind of person or chimpanzee or whatever do I want to be?
Hilary Bock describes an experiment in which two plastic numbers were placed in front of a chimp, each representing a corresponding pile of food. The chimps had been taught that whichever number they pointed to, that many pieces of food would go to another monkey, and they'd get to eat the second pile. So, naturally, the monkeys picked the smaller number and were rewarded with a larger pile of food. But when the plastic numbers were replaced with actual food, things fell apart.
They couldn't help themselves. They would always point to the big pile of food, even though they knew that then the big pile would be given to the other monkey. They just couldn't help going for the big pile of food. And what was interesting is that they were capable of getting it right when they were presented with the little plastic numbers, which are more abstract and which I think allow for more room for reflection. But when they were presented with piles of food, they could not help themselves.
Perhaps that explains why we sometimes turn into monkeys too, letting rage or desire get in the way of our ability to exercise free will.
When a person acts in a reflexive way or when they're mentally ill, so that they don't have the ability to think critically about what they're doing, they don't have free will. But when a person can think about what she's doing and make a decision and act accordingly, then I would say that that person acts freely and that she's morally responsible for what she does.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
Wow, Ken. Amy Standen gave us Alfred Hitchcock and Hilary Bock. What a great piece. And we have those poor kids that were affected by nature and read Nietzsche. Nature and Nietzsche. One is hard to figure out and one is hard to spell. What a combination.
There you go.
I'm John Perry here with Ken Taylor. This is Philosophy Talk, and we're discussing free will. Do we have control over our own lives, our actions, or are we just pawns?
And to help us think about these deep, hard questions is John Fisher of the University of California at Riverside. John is a member of our Board of Advisors for Philosophy Talk. He's the author of several works on the topic, including a book called The Metaphysics of Free Will and a forthcoming book, I gather, called Essays on Moral Responsibility. So he's a perfect guy to talk to us today. John, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here, Ken and John.
Hi, John. It's a usual beautiful day down there in sunny Southern California.
absolutely beautiful.
Oh,
the sky is blue and the traffic wasn't even that bad.
Well, it's somber up here, but we'll try to be infected by your enthusiasm in discussing this difficult philosophical topic. Now, right. Ken and I discussed earlier about the basic idea of freedom, doing what you want when you could have done otherwise. Determinism, the idea that even human actions are the result of the unfolding of the causes of the universe that have just been going on and on and on, and the effect that seems to have in undermining moral responsibility. A concept we didn't get to that's very important in this discussion is compatibilism, this strange idea that some philosophers have that there's really no problem. Maybe you could start by kind of explaining that to us.
It is a strange view. I think most people first of all, find it very jarring. And in fact, it's been the butt of a lot of philosophical jokes or attacks. Kant called it a wretched subterfuge. And William James called it a quagmire of evasion.
Okay, John Perry, John Perry named the doctrine. You told some jokes about the doctrine. Now explain the doctrine.
I called it some names. Well, the doctrine is that just like the compatibility of software and hardware or two pieces of software, compatibilism is the doctrine that free will is compatible with causal determinism, say, or even God's foreknowledge, but we can start with causal determinism. That means even if causal determinism turned out to be true, and we don't know, presumably, whether it is true, but even if it turned out to be true, we could still be in control of our behavior in such a way as to be morally responsible.
Okay, so let's get this down to cases. So here we've got Ken bonking me on the head. That's our example du jour. Right. And here Ken bonks me on the head, not because somebody's got a gun to his head or he's got a nervous tick, but he wants to. He says, I want to bonk John Perry on the head, so he does it. And I hold him morally responsible. Then I reflect, but wait a minute. That was just the unfolding of causes. It was determined by nature that he would want to do that by things that were true even before he was born. I can't really hold him morally responsible. It wasn't really free. Now, you're telling me philosophers are going to come along and say, no, no problem, no problem. How could that be so?
There are different versions of compatibilism, but on a traditional version, the idea is this, that first of all, if our actions, if our choices and our actions were not determined, that would even be a worse problem because that would seem to indicate that everything we did was random or accidental or didn't really flow from our own character. So we want our choices and our actions to be determined, at least by our past and by our values. Secondly, the idea is there are different kinds of causation. Not all causes are created equal. And when the causal chain flows through me in the right way, then I'm in control of my choices and actions. And Hilary Bock alluded to some of the features that make it the right way. So, for instance, I can step back from my desires and reflect on them, unlike a mere animal, like a cow or a pig or even a dog. A chimpanzee, I think, is kind of in between. But I can step back from my urges and my instincts and reflect on them and begin to frame general rules and accept values or moral principles.
John, now that you put it that way... Look, it doesn't sound... You guys started out saying this was a strange doctrine, an incredible doctrine. It sounds to me like a really cool doctrine, because now what does it say? It says that among the causes in the world is me. I'm a cause. My beliefs, my desires, my aspirations cause me to act. And when my beliefs and desires cause me to act, and cause me to act in the right kind of... cause me in the right way to act, then my actions count as my responsibility. Now, those beliefs and desires are themselves effects of other causes, but so what? It's
Wait a minute,
What? It sounds like what's wrong with compatibilism?
Wait a minute. What do you guys mean, so what?
Well, I said so what. John didn't say so what.
Ken wants to bonk me. That's because of a desire he has. So, okay. So he gets to do what he wants. I guess he's free in that sense. But isn't that a pretty superficial sense? Why did he have that desire? Well, because the way he's wired up. Well, you say, he's not a chimpanzee. He could have chosen otherwise. He could have overcome that desire. Well, why didn't he? Why isn't he the kind of person who, when he wants to bonk his co-host on the head, thinks to himself, but that would be wrong? Well, he's not that kind of person because of previous causes. I mean, it's all just causes.
Okay,
it's not
now,
Ken's fault at all.
Now, let's see. Let's see.
Don't bonk me on the head.
I'm gonna let John respond to you in a little bit. I'm going to remind our listeners that you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're asking the question, the deep, hard question, is free will an illusion? We're doing so with John Fisher from the University of California at Riverside.
Coming up, we'll take your comments and questions. Are we fully responsible for our actions? We know that criminals often come from abusive, traumatic backgrounds. Does that mean we can't blame them for what they do? We'll take your calls after the break.
And remember, folks, you can check out our new blog, our cool blog, where John Fisher's already joined us. John Perry put something up there, and so did I this morning. You can go to our webpage, www.philosophytalk.org, and click on the blog button up there at the top.
And if you're interested in reading about the problem of free will, a couple places you might try are that you can paperbacks you can get at your local bookstore. Hume's Inquiry is a classic text, and he's got a chapter in there called On Liberty and Necessity. Great reading. He's a compatibilist. Robert Caine is a contemporary philosopher who's just published an excellent little book from Oxford University Press called Free Will, and he's not a compatibilist. So you get both sides of the question there.
Philosophy Talk will be right back.
Roger Williams with Born Free from the 1966 film of the same name. I'm John Perry, and Ken, I think that is one weird song. I mean, if you listen to the lyrics, as free as the grass grows, I mean, given the erudite discussion we've been having, that makes no sense at all. The grass doesn't have wants or desires. It just sits there, and it grows up if the sun shines, and it goes...
That's a different...
I mean...
It's a different sense of freedom.
Who chooses this music?
I mean, that's freedom without kind of constraints or burdens or something like that, without the burdens of human life. Anyway, I'm Ken Taylor. You're John Perry.
Yes, thank
our
you.
Subject today on Philosophy Talk is free will. Are we born with it? Is there really such a thing? Or is it just an illusion? Tell us what you think. Do so by calling 415-841-4134.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
841-4134.
And if you have the misfortune to be outside the wonderful Bay Area, you can still reach us if you're determined to do so at 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
And our guest today is John Fisher of the University of California at Riverside, author of the forthcoming book, Essays on Moral Responsibility. John, I want to go back to what we were talking about just before the break. I didn't give you a chance to respond to John Perry. I know that you're something of a compatibilist. You're kind of a semi-compatibilist, whatever that means. So on behalf of the compatibilist, John thinks that's just a crazy doctrine. What do you say to John?
Yeah, I want to agree with both of you. That is, I think not all causal chains are created equal. When I reflect and frame general principles, I can exercise a distinctive kind of control of my behavior that a mere animal can't. On the other hand, I agree with John, or I'm inclined very strongly to agree with John, that if everything flows from past causes via the natural laws, then I can't do otherwise, then I'm not free to do otherwise. And so what's distinctive about my kind of compatibilism, which I call semi-compatibilism, is that I sever the connection between acting freely and freedom to do otherwise. So I want to have my cake and eat it too. I want to have the plausible features of libertarianism. I want to agree that causal determinism would entail that I couldn't ever have done otherwise, but I still want to say that I can act freely.
Is that just because you're cheating? I mean, you said a lot there. I mean, it sounds like a big cheat. Libertarianism, that's the view that there's this freedom and the possibility of doing otherwise, so it kind of the absence of determinism.
Right, the absence of determinism and the presence of freedom.
Yeah, so, and the ability to do otherwise. You want to have both
Let me see if I can put it in my own words. So when we were talking about freedom, two different ideas came up. One is freedom is doing what you want. Having your own desires determine what you do, not somebody else's who's holding a gun to your head, or not just having your desires short-circuited, as is the case when you fall down or you have a tic that makes your arm move. Freedom, concept number one, doing what you want. Freedom, concept number two, is you could have done otherwise. And that's really a little bit different. it seems the same psychologically, because when I do something because I want to, I think, well, I could have done otherwise. But really, you say, what determinism rules out is this second concept, that you could have done otherwise.
Exactly.
But maybe it doesn't rule out that first concept, and maybe that's the one needed for moral responsibility. And then we have this nifty view with this really boring name, semi-compatibilism.
But not a boring
guy.
Hey,
I'd be open. John, I'd be open to a better, Dave, if you could come up with one. But yes, you
how about,
put it
How about severed freedom? You use
wait a minute, though. Wait a minute, you guys. You're going much too fast for me. I don't think this makes any sense yet. So this freedom to do what I want to do, that just takes somebody's not holding me down. There aren't any chains, as it were. So I'm sitting here and I want to stand up. I'm free to stand up if I want to stand up because there's nothing holding me down. I can force of gravity isn't too strong. Nobody's got me tied down, right? But that doesn't. Why does that? What does that have to do with moral responsibility? I mean, I'm determined to stand up, I couldn't have done otherwise. That seems the thing that's relevant to moral responsibility, not this weak-kneed, uninteresting notion of freedom.
Right. Well, my notion of acting freely is more than just doing what you want to do. It's you have to own the process that issues in your choice. It has to be your own reasons-responsive process. And again, that's a lot of words. But the idea is when you act freely, it's not just that you're acting on your desire. After all, your desire could have been implanted by some process like hypnosis or even direct stimulation of the brain or some weird psychological problem that you have. So it's not just doing what you want to do, but it's doing what you choose to do as a result of your own process of deliberation, which is sensitive to the reasons that there are in the world.
Let me ask you, okay, wait a minute. You said you have to own this process of deliberation. You have to own these desires. You said that with great emphasis. But what does that take other than there being inside your skull? What do you mean by that?
I mean, just saying a metaphor loudly doesn't make it philosophical analysis, John. Come on.
No.
Yeah.
But
so what do you mean by that?
Well, I try and say it more than once. But not just loudly. I read somewhere that no one believes anything unless you say it at least twice.
Yeah, we learned that in radio. That's why we repeat ourselves.
Yeah, we learned that in radio. That's why we repeat ourselves.
Okay, John, go ahead.
Well, I believe that the mechanism that issues in your choice becomes your own when you take responsibility. I get control by taking control. I become responsible by taking responsibility. And that means I begin to notice that my choices that my bodily movements depend on my choices, and effects in the world depend on my bodily movements. And I also notice that other people hold me accountable under certain circumstances for the effects in the world. And through this process of moral education, which sometimes goes better than others, I get to the point where I take responsibility for the mechanisms that issue in my choices and my behavior.
Okay, okay. Let me see if I can sum this up before we get some other voices in here.
Okay.
So you say, well, look, blame goes with punishment. And when does punishment make sense? Punishment makes sense is if the threat of punishment or the execution of punishment will change what a person wants. So Ken wants badly to hit me, but if punishment is in the offing, if our producer Amy Stan is going to come in here and glare at him if he does that, then he'll also have another desire. Oh, as much as I want to hit John, I really don't want that stare from the producer. So
exactly.
In the end, he doesn't. So you're saying moral responsibility really goes with this concept of freedom is doing what we want when those wants are important to us and are kind of things we can change and therefore the kind of things that can be affected by punishment. Is that kind of the idea?
Roughly speaking, yes, yeah. When it's reasons responsible.
Pretty persuasive, John.
Well, sort of persuasive. We'll see. You can join this discussion. Why don't you give us a call? 415-841-4134.
This is an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
If you have the misfortune of being out of this lovely place, you can give us a call at 1-800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917. And last but not least, you can send us an email, comments@philosophytalk.org. And Maynard in Oakland is on the line now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Maynard.
Hello, thank you. I'm glad the conversation wandered back to the thoughts that I was having at the beginning of the program and kind of involving punishment and why punish or not punish.
Maynard, it wasn't wandering. It was closely determined to follow exactly that course
It could have gone no other way.
Yeah,
sure.
Absolutely no other way could it have gone.
Anyway, Maynard, what's your comment?
I guess the point I wanted to make was that the idea that there is a human agent with free will is a useful construct, but it doesn't. I guess I'm a compatibilist in that I don't really care whether there really is truly such a thing or not, because it's just a focal point for our trying to affect that person's behavior, whether we're acting on a set of causes or whether we're acting on a person with free will. And just kind of like you guys were starting to talk about punishment or other sort of persuasion or other kind of tweaking of the future causes that this person might be influenced by is
Maynard, you don't sound like a compatibilist to me. You don't care about freedom. Freedom might just as well be an illusion by your lights, but you think that even if there isn't any freedom, it doesn't matter. You seem like a really hard determinist, incompatibilist.
He's got kind of a pretty complicated view here. It's kind of interesting. It's that freedom is an illusion, but it's an illusion that serves a purpose because it kind of helps us focus on the kinds of causes that will change a person's behavior. Matter of fact, sounds a little like semi-compatibilism to me.
What do you think, John Fisher?
No, it's very different. Semi-compatibilism argues that we are in control in a very robust way, but not in the could have done otherwise way, but we are in control, and that we can be very robustly morally responsible. We deserve certain reactions by others and even punishment in certain circumstances. The view that's being considered is actually, yes, a version of hard determinism, which gets rid of the notion of control and responsibility robustly construed, thinks of free will and control as a kind of useful illusion, thinks of punishment as just something that changes our behavior and not something that we deeply deserve. So it's a very different view.
Let me break in here to explain some standard philosophical terminology. So we've got the determinists, the people that believe that the world really is governed by causal laws, including human actions. And sometimes those are divided into the hard determinists that say, and because of that, there's no free will, there's no freedom. And the soft determinists, who are compatibilists, like John Fisher, who say, you know, they're determinists. And I don't know if John Fisher's determinist, but if you were a determinist, you'd say, even though I'm a determinist, I still believe in freedom, so I'm a soft determinist. So we got hard and soft determinists, compatibilists, libertarians, all kinds of animals in this zoo.
And it really is a zoo. But one thing I'd like to mention is the Israeli philosopher Saul Smolansky has some very interesting work about freedom and illusion. And he argues that just what the caller is suggesting, that freedom is a kind of useful illusion. I don't buy into that. I think freedom is real. It's just not necessarily alternative possibilities freedom.
John, but the hard determinist would say to you, or maybe the libertarian would say to you, you're just pretending. This is you're granting it's an illusion. But what you're trying to do is you're trying to think up a new notion of control that isn't really control, because it really doesn't give you alternative possibilities. You know, it could have gone this way and it could have gone that way, and which way it goes is entirely up to me. You give that away, and then you say, well, I still want to keep the word freedom. So you're just cheating, the libertarian would say.
Right. Well, I disagree, and here's I'll make this quick. Suppose you're driving your car and you're at the controls, you're at the steering wheel, and you steer the wheel to the right because you want to go to Starbucks or you want to go to a coffee shop on the right. And everything works just like it normally works and just like the car is designed to work. I would say you guide the car, you control the car in its movements to the right. But let's say that unbeknownst to you, the steering apparatus was broken in such a way that had you tried to make the car go in any other direction, straight ahead or left, it would have still veered off to the right in exactly the same way it actually went. You couldn't have done otherwise. You couldn't have caused the car to go in any other direction, and yet you guided the car and you controlled the car in an extremely robust way. Your guidance control of that car was real.
So I think I'm getting a better and better grasp on your view. Say, well, okay, we accept determinism, we accept causation, but still we have this idea that our own wants and desires, and particularly the ones that we've thought over and accepted as really ours, play a causal role. Now, that could be an illusion. That could be an illusion, as when I turn the car to the right and it accidentally goes to the right even though the steering thing is broken. But it's not always an illusion. Sometimes it's us, our wants and desires, that really cause things. That's a little relevant to a question we've got from email. This is from Pete in San Francisco. Hi, guys. Can some diabolic entity, say a political leader, a troubling institution, or an army, coerce a subject into thinking said subject has free will and therefore achieve the ultimate manipulation of the subject? And is that diabolic entity exercising free will in doing so? Well, that's kind of a complicated question, but some people think that God plays that role. He just created this thing and gave us foster the illusion of freedom. And some people think the American government does that. But I'll let you comment on all that.
I believe that, yes, there are, at least in principle or as a thought experiment, these kinds of manipulations are possible. And very briefly, I'd just like to read a couple sentences from my mentor, Carl Genet at Cornell University, who says, "In those rides that amusement parks sometimes provide in which one sits in a car that follows a track through a darkened room of illuminated objects, the car sometimes has a steering wheel. If one turns the wheel in the direction suggested by the environment, directions in which the car is actually going, one can easily get the feeling that one is steering the car, even though one knows all along that he is not. A child might think he was actually steering the car." So, and you
are,
can
you,
think
are
of,
you telling me that I'm not steering those cars at Disneyland?
Well, what I'm saying is, it's possible to be wrong about your sense of freedom, or at least it's possible to have a sense that you are free, and for that sense to be false.
I think you have a point. Why don't you out there in Radio Land join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134. That's
you're hearing an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
Outside the Bay Area, 1-800-525-9917. And Mohan in San Francisco has a thought along the lines we were just talking. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mohan.
Well, thank you. I've always been interested in the concept of freedom and different cultures, I guess what people call cultural relativity. And personally, I would absolutely love to see freedom defined in the framework of human rights. However, that is not what usually happens. I'm from India, and in countries such as India, which is a very vibrant democracy, as well as other countries which are not democracies, you know, such as countries in the Middle East and Pakistan, freedom usually gets defined by cultures or by the religious framework of people, which generally leads to deprivation of freedom. And I guess it's religion triumphing or religious freedom triumphing over, you know, human rights.
Mohan, I think you're talking more about political freedom, which is an important concept, but it's really different from the notion of freedom we're talking about. Because you could have political freedom, that is, freedom to do what you want, freedom of expression, on either of the incompatibilist, compatibilist views. If political freedom just meant freedom to do, right, what you want to do, then anybody can grant that. Don't you think that's right, John Fisher?
No, what about freedom from oppression and freedom from slavery?
Yeah, those are different. Those are different notions of freedom. Thanks for the call, Mohan. I'll remind our listeners, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about free will, freedom, and determinism, the nature of moral responsibility, with our guest, John Fisher of the University of California at Riverside.
And I want to say, with respect to what Mohan said, that as you get into the realms of political freedom, this idea that John Fisher is pushing, that the real crux of freedom is not absence of determinism, but presence of the ability to have your own wants influence what you do, becomes more and more plausible as an analysis of how we use the word freedom.
Give us a call. Tell us what you think. Philosophy Talk will be right back.
The Rolling Stones with I'm Free. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. You can join our discussion on free will by calling 415-841-4134.
This is an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
Toll free, 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917. Or email us, comments@philosophytalk.org. You know, Ken, I'm really getting into deconstructing this music. You've got the Rolling Stones enunciating a very compatibilist version of freedom. I'm free to do what I want. But think of the think of their name, the Rolling Stones. I mean, a Rolling Stone is
well,
action
go,
with no freedom, no wants, no desires. I think music
Okay. I don't think I'm going to get any satisfaction unless I introduce this example, because Ken was accusing me of cheating, or on behalf of the libertarian was saying, you're just introducing some minimal notion of control, but it's not real. I want to go back to the example just for a second that was suggested by John Locke and developed in contemporary philosophy by Harry Frankfurt, and I sketched it on the blog.
Well, do it more succinctly than Locke would.
Okay, here it is. A man is asleep, and he's put in a room, and when he awakens, he deliberates about whether to leave the room, and he decides to stay in the room to talk to a friend or to play cards, but for his own reasons. Unbeknownst to him, the door is locked, so he couldn't have left the room. It seems to me that this is a good example of doing something freely, even when you couldn't have done otherwise.
Well, it's certainly doing something of your own will when you couldn't have done otherwise. I mean, he willed to stay in the room, and so he stayed in the room. But it seems to me, I think you're begging the question against the libertarian to say that he did it freely. I mean, he couldn't have done otherwise. He did do it of his own will, but that's, you know, I don't know. And you can ask the question, what does it take to be of his own will? That's a different question. We've got lots of callers on the line. I'm going to let some of them in now. Robert in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Robert.
Hi, I'd like to tell you how much I appreciate the conversation. Being raised in a five-point Calvinist church, and I'm familiar with all the ins and outs of these arguments. But I'd like to ask a question of you gentlemen, how this relates to the hard science of biology and paleontology, and particularly Stephen Gould's work, It's a Wonderful Life, where he shows from the fossil record the almost endless different types of life that could have been, and yet they've all gone extinct. And we've ended up with what we have now. And his hypothesis is that there is no determinism and that it is all random.
Oh.
And I'd like to get your comment on that.
I don't think thanks for the question, Robert. I don't think it follows from anything Gould says that determinism is false. It's that the walk through the evolutionary space is a kind of random walk of a certain kind, but that doesn't follow that determinism in our sense is false.
So your point, Ken, is that what we usually call randomness is compatible with an underlying determinism. You see this in a roulette wheel. A roulette wheel gives you what, as far as we're concerned, is a random distribution of reds and blacks and greens. But that, even so, its operations are probably deterministic. Mm-hmm. It's just that we have no idea what the little causes are, and so we can't game it and win a lot of money.
Stan in Alameda is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Stan.
Thank you very much. I had one quick comment and then a question. The comment is that I believe completely in free will, and I also have a faith basis in terms of God, and I think that the two are compatible. But the question is, what do older philosophers... What did they have to say about free will, people like Plato, Kant, Nietzsche?
Well, we can't give you a complete tour.
I know you can't do it.
Yeah, but John Fisher, want to give him a brief tour?
Well, you're suggesting I'm an older philosopher?
Well, John's the oldest philosopher here, but, you know.
Right, okay. So, John, yeah, the other John.
Yeah, John Barry.
Well, free will is a central topic in the history of philosophy, and it's one of the great philosophical topics. I can't give you a thumbnail sketch. They've said just about everything.
Yeah, they've been all over the map.
Well, Hume was a compatibilist.
Yeah, he was a compatibilist. Reed was an incompatibilist.
Tell you what we'll do. We'll put up lots of stuff on our webpage that
do
helped
it on
our
the
reading.
Blog. Yeah. But what I would want to say is there are some real challenges for free will within a religious tradition like the Judeo-Christian tradition. And one challenge is if God is perfect and he's omniscient and he exists in time, then he knew in the year 1900, before any of us were born, any of us at least in this conversation, and that includes John Perry, he knew in the year 1900 exactly what we would choose and exactly what we would do at every point in our lives. How can you reconcile that with freedom and with moral responsibility? And how is it fair for God to put us in hell for what we do if he knew all along exactly what we would do? So there are some really interesting challenges there.
And one of our listeners, Ben in Half Moon Bay, has sent an interesting email that I think gets at one of the things about free will that we haven't really done justice to. That's the feeling that we have a kind of freedom that involves transcending our causes. He talks about someone trapped in a relationship. I won't go through it all. He says, but free will permits the person to step outside the situation. All the senses say the person is confined, but thought and education permits the person to step outside of the environmentally established constraints and to make change. So there is a sense we have as people that we can kind of transcend the wants and desires that were programmed into us.
Yeah,
we can transcend the wants and desires by forming values and general rules, but I don't know that that implies that we're transcending nature or transcending causation.
Probably
John,
not.
John, on that note, I'm gonna have to let you go because, but I'll tell you, it's been a great conversation. It's been too brief. We'll continue the conversation, though. John's agreed to weigh in on our blog some more. So our guest has been John Fisher of the University of California at Riverside, author of the forthcoming book, My Way, Essays on Moral Responsibility, due out pretty soon, I gather, from Oxford University Press. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, John, and thanks to all who called in and all who emailed in. We didn't get to all of them, but we appreciate your calls and emails.
And remember, check out the blog. Go to www.philosophytalk.org and click on the blog button. John, so what do you think? Where's your mind today?
Well, I think free will is one of the or freedom and determinism is one of the really hard philosophical problems because everything comes into it: consciousness, philosophy of science, the nature of causation, so forth and so on. Basically, we set up the problem, freedom versus determinism. We mentioned the connection with moral responsibility. We talked about this view of compatibilism, and then John Fisher's view, semi-compatibilism. So we've kind of gone through a whole raft of positions here in less than an hour.
But you know what we didn't get to do? I didn't get to convince you guys, which I really believe, that this supposed connection between freedom and moral responsibility, where freedom is something metaphysically deep, is wrong. I mean, I think if you just look at what people respond to when they attribute moral responsibility to a person, they respond to sort of intact, mature human willing and human believing. And that's really all you need. Intact, mature human beings deciding what to do. And that doesn't really give you freedom in any deep sense.
Well, that sounds to me a lot like John Fisher's view. He's saying that what's required for moral responsibility isn't excluded by determinism. And then he goes on to say, and we can call that freedom, and you're a little reluctant there. But except for the terminology, it sounds like you kind of agree with
well,
him.
Well, in some ways we agree, but he, on the blog, he disagrees with me. We're having a little debate about this, folks, on the blog, so you go and check it out. But I really do think he's just cheating, you know? He's just cheating. He's trying to call freedom something that the libertarian, who's really the big friend of freedom, wouldn't acknowledge. And why do you just to get the redub the word? I don't think we should fight about the word. Look at what human beings actually do.
Not fight about the word?
Yeah.
What, you're going to undermine our entire profession.
Yeah,
here.
I know.
Here, Ken. That's what, you know, there's been a lot of movies that concern the whole concept of freedom, and one of the pretty good ones that came out within the recent past, not last month, is a Minority Report with Tom Cruise. Did you see that, Ken?
Yeah, you know, I know what you mean. I really like it. So why don't we cue up the music and take Philosophy Talk to the movies?
Now, in this movie, Tom Cruise plays a guy named Anderton, who's one of the big honchos in the pre-crime program.
Pre-crime? What's a pre-crime?
Well, they go out and they capture people who are about to murder someone, and they know that because of three precogs. These are brain-damaged people that somehow have the ability to foretell the future. They don't tell you the future. They just dream about it, except it's not a dream. It's somehow a perception of the future. This is made available to the precognitive detectives and officers, and they go out and stop the crime before it happens.
So wait a minute. The precognition people foresee the crime, and then the police go out and stop the crime before it happens? So the precognition people foresee a crime that doesn't happen?
They foresee a crime that doesn't happen. And by the way, the person who would have done the crime is convicted of being about to do a crime.
It's not called a crime. It's called a pre-crime. They're convicted of the pre-crime of murder.
Pre-crime of murder. And there are a few things that I found a little peculiar. This is a pilot program in Washington, D.C., and so the precogs only seem to precognize murders that are going to happen in Washington, D.C. But soon the program is going to go national, and then apparently they'll be able to precognize crimes all over the country.
Yeah.
I mean, how do they control which crimes they're going to precognize?
That's kind of a deus ex machina kind of thing. But what does it have to do with freedom and determinism and whether freedom is an illusion, that as we've just been talking about?
Well, the Tom Cruise character, Anderton, eventually gets a little wooden ball, which is how the precogs somehow communicate with the outside world, that says that he's going to murder someone. And he escapes the compound before they can arrest him for the crime he's about to commit. He eventually kidnaps Agatha, the leading precognizer, the most intelligent and effective precognizer, and she convinces him that he actually has freedom and can refrain from committing the crime that he's predestined to commit. Now, that's the message of the thing. We do have free will.
Wait a minute. You're taking this a little too fast for me. Let's see if we can slow down. So look, you can foresee the future, right? And these guys are convicted for the pre-crimes that they would have committed, right? Now, if you can see the future, then I guess the future is bound to happen. If the future weren't bound to happen, then you couldn't foresee it because it would be an open question what the future would be like, right? If the future is bound to happen and you can foresee it, there's nothing you can do about it. So where's the freedom? Isn't it an anti-freedom movie?
I think a few problems with the movie in terms of whether it has a coherent picture of precognition. So precognition, as it's presented, is like perception. We tap into these precogs' minds and we get something that can be recorded on videotape that shows images of the thing actually happening. Now, if that's perception, we usually think of perception as something that's caused by an external event and leads to a representation in the mind. So we must have the future causing something in the past. That might be okay. But then how can that thing that has already caused the precognition turn out not to happen? That's puzzling.
The commission of the crime itself is absolute metaphysics. The precogs see the future and they're never wrong.
But it's not the future if you stop it. Isn't that a fundamental paradox?
Yes, it is. You're talking about predetermination, which happens all the time.
And Tom Cruise takes one of these little balls and rolls it down a ramp. And the guy reaches out and catches the ball.
Why'd you catch that?
Because it was going to fall.
You're certain?
Yeah,
but it didn't fall.
You caught it.
The fact that you prevented it from happening doesn't change the fact that it was going to happen.
You ever get any false positives?
Someone intends to kill his boss or his wife, but they never go through with it. How do the precogs tell the difference?
Precog starts to see what you intend to do, only what you will do.
That suggests a different picture of precognition, which is that it's not based on perception of the future. It's based on perception of the present, that these people are somehow in tune with what the actual mental states of the would-be murderers are. That's mysterious, but it just involves something a little bit less mysterious than knowing the future. And then they're able to figure out and visualize in a perception-like way, but it's not actually perception, what's going to happen. Now, that would be consistent with what happens in the movie, but it wouldn't really be precognition. It would be just kind of weird prediction based on extrasensory perception of somebody else's mind that happens to live in the Washington, D.C. area.
Yeah, well, you're hung up on this Washington, D.C. area thing. But in the end, the movie starts out sounding like it's arguing on behalf of determinism that we talked a lot about earlier. But in the end, it actually argues against determinism because it says the future is open. There are alternative possibilities. And at the climactic moment, one of the climactic moments of the movie, Agatha says to the Tom Cruise character, "You can choose. You can choose to go left rather than right. It's not completely determined."
Yes, but I think a compatibilist could give a consistent interpretation of the movie. They'd say, well, what they're precognizing is not the future. They're just making a prediction based on intervention not happening.
Right.
And when intervention does happen, the intervention itself may have been caused by things that they didn't take into account. So you could still have a compatibilist account of the whole movie.
Minority Report doesn't solve the problem of freedom versus determinism, but, you know, it's a good dramatization. It raises some nice issues and discusses them intelligently. And If people haven't seen it, they should.
One of the best movies Tom Cruise has ever made. Not saying a lot, but saying something. Ken, it's fun talking about movies, but it's also fun to help our listeners talk about the philosophical problems that arise in our own life.
Yeah, if you've got a conundrum, you can send us an email at conundrums@philosophytalk.org. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Dave Fusaro, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association and from various groups at Stanford University.
And even more support from the Friends of Philosophy Talk and from the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.